Well, he's at it again. Who is he, you may ask? His name is Michael Newdow, and if you're a regular listener, you've heard that name before, because several years back, we did an entire episode devoted to the Reverend Dr. Michael Newdow Esquire's battle against the phrase "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance, and that's a case he took all the way to the United States Supreme Court. That one didn't work out too well for him, for reasons we'll discuss, but now he's challenging another common phrase, including the word God. This one's called "In God We Trust," our national motto, which is popping up everywhere these days. Dr. Newdow doesn't think that's a good idea. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about "In God We Trust."
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Mike Newdow is a remarkable fellow who's been on our show before. Some years ago, we interviewed him about his battle that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court over the phrase "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance. And recently, he is back in the news. He has been challenging another common phrase, another one that you've heard, called "In God We Trust," our national motto, which Michael Newdow thinks should be taken off of our currency for reasons that are deeply rooted in equality and also in something called the Establishment Clause of the United States Constitution. We'll speak to Mike in just a second. And after we do that, we'll talk also to another fellow who's on the other side of this issue. His name is Matt Staver, and he is the former dean of Liberty University's School of Law. But now let's start with Michael Newdow.
My name is Mike Newdow. I'm an emergency physician and part-time lawyer. And I use the physician to support me so that I can act pro bono to get the government to do what it's supposed to do.
You are a remarkable combination of professions, aren't you?
There's lots of us out there. Most people though use them together and are smart. I'm not.
Well, I must say that you do have a very impressive background. You are a medical doctor, and I believe, where did you go? Was it the University of Chicago for medical school?
UCLA for med school.
And then is it Michigan or Chicago for law school?
Michigan.
So for most people, it would be quite enough to obtain such a prestigious law degree or such a prestigious medical degree. But you have them both. And then on top of law and medicine, I think you hit a trifecta of some of the traditional professions because you're also a minister, aren't you?
Also a minister and an RV park owner.
And an RV park owner. You've covered everything, Mike. As fascinating as all that is, that's not specifically why we're talking to you. In fact, we've spoken to you once before because your last name, Newdow, has made its way into the United States reports. You have actually had a case in the past that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And that was one we talked about with you a few years ago, was when you challenged the phrase "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance. Could you just recap that controversy briefly?
The public schools, which are supposed to stay neutral in terms of religious belief, start off every day in some schools, or at times in others, asking the children to stand up, place their hands on their heart, and say that we are a nation under God. And there's no difference to me, at least constitutionally, between asking us to say we're one nation under Jesus or one nation under Buddha or one nation under anything else religious. We have an establishment clause that says government can't do that. And the Supreme Court itself has said government can't do that. They haven't specifically said it in regard to the pledge, but they've said it every time they've spoken in terms of the principles of the establishment clause. They said this kind of stuff can't be done. And I brought the case, and the Supreme Court punted and didn't decide it.
Yeah, we won't go too much into that, but it was, I think most constitutional scholars were very, very disappointed when the court refused to consider. You actually won at the appellate level. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with you. And briefly, at least, in theory, it was unconstitutional for public school teachers to lead public school children in the Pledge of Allegiance, including the phrase "under God," which was added in the 1950s, for a brief period of time while the Ninth Circuit agreed with you. But the Supreme Court, when it took the case, punted, as you say, on the basis of something called standing. And that was really and truly unfortunate because it was not really the issue in the case. They never really got to the Establishment Clause issue. So we were left wondering, and to this day wondering, about the Pledge of Allegiance. But that's what we talked about before. And if anyone is interested in hearing the full discussion with me and with you, they can go and actually look at our podcast site. It's on iTunes as well. And it was called "Is the Pledge of Allegiance Unconstitutional?" I thought it was a fascinating episode. But you're at it again. You're at it again. You are now out there attacking God in another context, or at least the word God. This time, however, it's in God we trust. What's up with that?
Let me just say that if I'm not attacking God at all, if that's what just
no, I meant to
I'm
say you attack the word God. Yeah.
Taking sides in terms of religion, any side. If they took the atheist side, it would be just as wrong and harmful. And we have a constitution, and the framers made it very clear the government's supposed to stay out of the religion business. And the idea that our national motto, I mean, we have a Bill of Rights that starts, Congress shall make no law respecting having anything to do with an establishment, not of a religion, but of religion generally. And the idea that our national motto would violate the first 10 words of our Bill of Rights is extraordinary. And so I'm trying to change that.
That national motto, well, we already had a national motto. Well, we've got another one actually called E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one. And you can see that on our money as well, or at least some of our money.
That is on the money. It's required, as is In God We Trust.
Right, but In God We Trust was added recently. In fact, it was added roughly the same time as the phrase Under God was added to the pledge, wasn't it?
I have a brief, and people should be encouraged to read it. Mm-hmm. If you just go to No More IGWT, because it's really, a fascinating historical lesson. You can go through it. It started actually in right during the Civil War time, mm-hmm. and in 1864 was the first coin that had it. And the director of the Mint said why he's putting it in there. He says, "We claim to be a Christian nation. Our national coinage should declare our trust in God. Which God? In him who is King of Kings and Lord of Lords." So it was a purely Christian monotheistic statement made by the government, which is forbidden. And he put that in the official Mint director's report. And he did it 5 years in a row. That's how it started. It was became mandatory on all coins and currency in the 1950s. And that's what you're referring to.
Right. Yeah. So the mandatory inclusion of that dates back to that same era as Under God does.
There was a whole slew of stuff. It was in a 5-year period. We had a prayer room stuck into the Capitol. We had a national day of prayer added. We had Under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, In God We Trust on all the coins, and then In God We Trust made our national motto, all in the space of 5 years.
Good heavens. Well, you've already told us about the original motivation back in the Civil War of why In God We Trust was put on some coins for some period of time. What was the motivation for including it in that 5-year period in the 1950s?
So actually there were three episodes, and it's all in that brief. Again, I'd encourage you, not because it's my complaint, but just it's really interesting stuff. I had a great time writing it.
And people can go to your No More IG.
No More IGWT, right.
No More In God We Trust. Okay, that's what it stands for.
Right.
And they can get your brief. Okay, so after the Civil War, what was the second episode of In God We Trust on our coinage?
In 1908, they tried to take off. Teddy Roosevelt decided we'd have beautiful coins. We should be like the old Romans, and he didn't like our coins. And so he had a very famous sculptor at the time, Augustus St. Gaudens is his name, and he decided that the motto and then all the verbiage was an inartistic intrusion upon the coins. And so they took it off. They took In God We Trust off. And there was a huge outcry, and they had the congressional hearing on it. And you go through the congressional hearing. I mean, you hear about, you know, this guy Washington Gardner from Michigan talking about how he hears that there are parents who teach their children that maybe they expose them to literature that says maybe God doesn't exist. He gets furious about that. He says those parents should not be saying things like that. We should get the government to get in there and teach them about the sacrificial cross upon which was pinioned the body of the Nazarene. I mean, you know, and that was not atypical for what everyone was saying there. It was clearly to restore Christianity to our coinage back then. And then we had the same thing again in the 1950s when a fellow in church during a Sunday sermon realized that, hey, we don't have In God We Trust on our currency. We have it on the coins. What's this? So he brought he contacted his congressman or senator, and again we had hearings. And this is all pre Lemon v. Kurtzman. All right. So as for those who don't know, Lemon v. Kurtzman was the case in 1971, where the Supreme Court came out and said you can't do things for a religious purpose. You can't do things that have religious effects. You, the government. And so this is before Congress knew that it couldn't say the things that it was saying, and it came out and said again and said, this is, you know, we are a Christian nation and we should do this because we worship God, etc. And then since 1971, Congress has been careful not to say what we all know they're really thinking, that they still want us to be a Christian nation and to worship God. And so they keep coming up with these bogus claims that, oh, this is just our heritage and all this other nonsense. But it's pretty clear through the history that this was done for religious purposes. And if you look in our society now, it's still done for religious purposes, and we know that.
That is remarkable because, of course, you're right. There's an implicit question in the phrase, "In God we trust," and that is, which God are you speaking of? And if I understand you correctly, from its very inception, all the way back to the Civil War, it's been very clear that they were talking about the Christian God, Jesus Christ.
King of kings and Lord of lords.
The Nazarene, exactly. Okay, so that was very, very clear throughout the legislative history.
And if I might interject,
sure.
Even if it wasn't, even if it was just a God, the idea of a God, whichever one you choose, that's still a religious claim that many people disagree with. And our government is supposed to show equal respect for all lawful religious views. And it is a lawful religious view now, it didn't used to be, to think that God doesn't exist. And we should show equal respect for that. And to say in God we trust, knowing there are people who specifically deny God's existence, is outrageous. It's not even close. So that's why I'm bringing this case.
Well, you know, let's fill in a little bit of the constitutional landscape. You've mentioned the case Lemon versus Kurtzman from 1971, and this area of law, the Establishment Clause, is a little bit dicey. It's a little bit confusing because the courts, it has a number of different tests it's used throughout the year, and probably the most, what we might call strict separationist test, the one that is most Jeffersonian and Madisonian in its perspective, is in fact the Lemon test, and it's a three-part test. And in order to satisfy that, any government action must have, a secular purpose. It can't advance or inhibit religion, and it can't entangle the government too much in religion. And if it does any of those three things, it's going to be unconstitutional. So it's a very, very significant test.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Michael Newdow, lawyer, doctor, and minister, all about his battle against the phrase, "In God we trust." After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz. We'll speak a bit more with Mike Newdow, and then later in the show, we'll hear from the other guys. We'll hear from Matt Staver of Liberty Counsel. Stick around. And now it's time for not one, but actually two constitutional quizzes recorded live at the We the People State Finals for high school students in the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Do you have an exceptionally hard question for our next contestant?
Oh, okay. Do we have a teacher? Oh, we have a teacher. We have a coach.
I don't really know much about this stuff. Please don't.
Skylar, you're good
question.
With this? All right.
Coach, who are you, for the record?
I am Skylar. I'm from Glen Allen High School.
From Scotland. Okay.
He is an advanced senior at Glen Allen.
I did two units, not one. Respect.
Okay. Do you have a good one for Scott?
Would you? Here's the question I'll give you. No chances. You have to come up with this yourself.
I'm going to get it wrong, and then it's going to...
All right.
All my validation.
Which Federalist paper begins with the words, "We proceed now to an examination of the Judiciary Department of the proposed government"?
Oh,
and who was its author?
Hamilton, 78. No, that's wrong.
Give that man a T-shirt.
Oh! Oh!
That is impressive. That's pretty good. Six essays from Hamilton, right?
Very nice. Hamilton, who's our next contestant?
Hamilton 78. Kind of sounds like a rock band. I don't know.
Hamilton 78?
Hamilton 78.
Franklin fronted for them for a while, right, when they toured through France.
Yeah, yeah. I think they might have.
And now Hamilton is touring in New York City. If you haven't seen it, highly recommend.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You need to go. Need to go to New York and
Alexander
see it. If
Hamilton.
You can get a ticket. Absolutely.
Hard ticket to get.
Who's our next contestant here? Another.
Any idea what time it is?
Another volunteer.
We're flying through these faster than I had expected.
We'll have another volunteer. Jesus, do you want to go?
It's all right. I'll take more time.
Nobody else has gotten it wrong. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Come on up. You might be the very first to get it wrong. We'll never know.
Tremendous. Here we are.
What's your...
Here we go.
Go ahead and introduce yourself.
My name is Danielle Davis, and I'm from Brunswick High School.
I'm sorry, it's Danielle?
Yes, sir.
It's a pleasure to see you, Danielle. Thank you very much for volunteering. Doug, let's give Danielle a really hard one.
Thank you, sir.
Absolutely. She looks pretty smart to me.
Don't let the glasses deceive you.
It's just the glasses? Okay.
Here's the question. You get four choices.
Do I also get help? Serious question.
In what state did the Federalist Papers first appear? Was it A, don't go looking for answers back there. Was it A, Philadelphia? B, Virginia? C, Asheville? Now I'm just playing along with you. Or D, New York City?
Wow, this is the hardest
question. Actually, I shouldn't say New York City,
life.
New York, because it's...
May you repeat those answer choices for me?
Sure. A, Philadelphia. B, Virginia. C, Asheville, North Carolina. Or D, New York State. In what state did the Federalist Papers first appear?
All right.
Now, we'll help you walk through this if you'd like. Asheville, North Carolina is not
a state.
So
is that the whole name of the state, or is that broken up into two separate states? I will have to go with Virginia as my final answer.
Wait a second, Virginia. Virginia, the state of Virginia, is where the Federalist Papers first appeared.
I'm just going with the only state that was provided.
Wait a second. No. There was another state in there. There's New York State as well.
Yeah, New York City?
No,
New York State.
He said New York City?
He did originally. He corrected himself. So there are at least two states in there. Just wanted to be clear on that one. Okay, now who's the primary author of the Federalist Papers?
The person who wrote it?
Yeah, the person who wrote it, definitely. Yeah, okay. And he was from? Uh-huh. She's looking over her shoulder.
I phoned
there.
A friend, and they said James Madison.
Yeah, James Madison was definitely part of the process. Yeah. This is we're actually going to have a phone a friend section here. How many people think that it was Virginia? Raise your hand if you think the Federalist first appeared. Wait a minute. Shh.
All right, show of hands.
Show of hands. How many people think the Federalist first appeared in Virginia? Okay, how many people think it first in Asheville, North Carolina? How many people think it appeared first in Philadelphia? And how many people, Philadelphia is not a state, but that's okay. You can think whatever you wish. It's a free country. And finally, how many people think it appeared first in New York State?
Ooh.
Okay, and now you've raised your hand as well, Danielle. So is New York State your final answer?
Yes.
I'm sorry, it's Virginia.
I said Virginia the first time.
No, I'm sorry. No.
I said it verbally.
Don't let him in. It is New York State.
All right.
New York Congratulations.
State. Get that T-shirt.
Very good. So our next
Although James Madison
here.
Played an extremely important role... James Madison played an extremely important role in the Federalist and wrote some of the more important ones. And John Jay played a minor role in it. The primary author was Alexander Hamilton. And of course, he was from New York City. And indeed, what's typically the first line in each of the Federalist Papers? What's the first line in them? Scott, help us out here. What's the first line in most of the Federalist Papers? How do they begin? Yeah, you. You know that. You're the one who came up with Hamilton 78. Someone check me. Lynn, what's typically the first line?
It's something like to the citizens.
To the people of the state of New York. Right. Yeah, that's all right. Most of these were written, remember, as newspaper articles, and they were very political documents. They were kind of like the modern equivalent of an op-ed piece. And they were written primarily in New York, where ratification was very, very dicey because there were local political powers, like Governor Clinton of New York, who were very anti-Federalist. But they were so persuasive and so well received by Federalists that they were widely reprinted in the rest of the country. And therefore, it was only in New York where they were first published.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm in the midst of a really interesting discussion with Mike Newdow, a doctor, a lawyer, a minister, who has previously challenged the phrase under God in the Pledge of Allegiance and is now in the midst of filing a number of lawsuits challenging the phrase in God we trust, which appears, of course, on U.S. currency. This involves a number of constitutional provisions, but perhaps most notably something called the Establishment Clause, which, broadly speaking, prohibits the United States from establishing an official church. But what precisely is the test that the Supreme Court is likely to use in evaluating such a case?
If there's any common concept to all the various Establishment Clause tests that the court has promulgated over the years, it's the idea of neutrality. And so that's consistent with what you say, is that the government should neither advance nor inhibit religion. And certainly your argument, if I understand you correctly, is that by proclaiming that we trust in God, any God, it's at the very least advancing religion generally over non-religion. And if one, looks at the legislative history, even one specific religion, Christianity over non-religion and over all other religions. And so in some sense, it's sort of a double violation of the Establishment Clause. But correct me if I'm wrong, this phrase, in God we trust, has actually been upheld by various federal courts, hasn't it?
By federal courts, yes. There's 12 circuits that you can deal in, and five have already ruled that it's okay.
Now, on
with
what
the
basis,
most bogus,
then?
Nonsensical, embarrassing jurisprudence anyone could imagine. One of the tests, you mentioned neutrality, and the Supreme Court very clearly stated the touchstone for our Establishment Clause jurisprudence, the touchstone for our analysis, is the principle that the First Amendment mandates governmental neutrality, not only between religion and religion, i.e., like Catholicism versus Judaism or whatever, but between religion and non-religion, and they were specifically referring to belief in God and disbelief in God. Right? They made that as clear. That's the touchstone for our analysis. So I raised that. The last time I brought this case was in New York, Second Circuit in 2013. And I said, how can you possibly say, as between belief in God and disbelief in God we trust is neutral? It's impossible. You got to be nuts. So they make this footnote, and they say, Newdow says we have to be neutral. I don't say it. The Supreme Court said it as clear as can be, right? And they put this little footnote, two sentences, and they say, yeah, but neutrality doesn't always answer the question. That's your answer? Okay, that's the entire analysis that they have. Yeah, first of all, neutrality doesn't answer the question when that's not the question. Here it is, as clear as can be. And they just punted on it again. It's embarrassing. These are three federal appellate judges. And they come up with this outrageous nonsense. The first time was in Aronow in the Ninth Circuit. They said, in God we trust has nothing whatsoever to do with an establishment of religion. Interestingly, at the time they said that, there were only two times the Supreme Court had ever discussed in God we trust. Both of them were Establishment Clause cases. And since then, we now have 11 cases, and essentially all of them were Establishment Clause issues. So the idea that they would say it has nothing whatsoever to do with an establishment of religion when the Supreme Court only talks about it during Establishment Clause cases, it's crazy. It's really horrible. And somebody, if you have students there who are looking for a law review article, just go through the shameful discussions by our federal appellate judges. So there are 12 circuits, as I mentioned, and the case has already been decided against the truth and justice and equality in five of those circuits, but there are seven circuits left, and we're bringing cases in all seven of those circuits essentially simultaneously.
And you found plaintiffs who have standing, which was the issue that tripped you up back in the Pledge of Allegiance days. I'm sure you've been very careful to find plaintiffs with good standing who have very specific individualized injuries.
Correct. We have at least, 15 plaintiffs, as many as 40, in some of those cases, but they won't be able to play that game again.
Any indication of any success thus far in any of your cases?
No, they were just served recently, and just two of them. I still have the five others to go to and serve the government. I let them know that all seven are going to be there, so I don't know how they want to handle it, but it'll be interesting. I'm just hoping that somewhere in the federal judiciary and the courts of appeals, there are two judges that are willing to uphold the principle of equality. People talk about Supreme Court precedent. There certainly is a lot of Supreme Court precedent. We have Scott v. Sanford, Bradwell v. Illinois, Pace v. Alabama, Plessy v. Ferguson, Minersville v. Gobitis, Korematsu, Bowers v. Hardwick. We got a lot of Supreme Court precedent. where the high court has decided that the principle of equality can be trampled on with some bogus nonsense excuse. But those have all been overruled.
Is there some reason why you decided to bring these cases simultaneously rather than just one after the other?
Yeah, the issue, and we've already gotten there to some degree, is that the judges, knowing full well that they're going to get reamed, I mean, you know, we might mention that when this Pledge of Allegiance came out and the case and the Ninth Circuit decided in the favor of equality, it was, you know, it was a huge uproar. That you had the Senator Robert Byrd, who sat up there and said, you know, if this judge ever comes before this court, he'll be blackballed, if you know what I mean, fast. I mean, you know, on the day it came out, I'm sure he hadn't even read the decision. You know, there was huge uproar. And so any judge that comes up and rules in our favor is going to get reamed. We know that. And so it's very safe for them to, you know, if we lose, it doesn't even, you know, no one even hears about it. So it's much safer for them to not do their job and to just, you know, rely on what's been happened before. So every time we get a case against us, we get more and more precedent, despite the fact that the precedent that we have relies goes back to that first case that where they said it had nothing whatsoever to do with an establishment of religion, a completely bogus, you know, idea. But so now, so if I keep doing it one at a time, then I just get, as it is, it's getting to be the point where it's somewhat overwhelming that we, you know, we have to get two judges to go against what's happened before. But, you know, if you get down to the last one and you got 11 courts that have ruled against us, that 12th court is going to find it difficult, especially difficult. So I figured, all right, we'll bring it all at once. And hopefully somebody out there, two judges, will say, yeah, you know, this isn't even a close case. We have to do what the Constitution demands, and we're willing to suffer the adverse publicity or whatever it is we get to uphold the Constitution. That's a noble calling. People say, oh, he's an atheist activist. I'm not at all. I stand up for the valedictorians who are, you know, evangelicals who want to talk about their relationship with Jesus at high school, you know, graduations. I think they have every right to do it. They earned it. That's not the government. But when the government gets involved, the government has to stay neutral, and it can't be pro-atheistic, it can't be pro-Christian, it can't be pro-anything. It has to be neutral. As the Supreme Court said, in 40 majority opinions, they've said this, okay? This isn't like, you know, an occasional thing. Every time they talk about this stuff, they say you have to be neutral. Now, they aren't neutral themselves at times. You know, when Marsh v. Chambers came out, the prayer before sessions of Congress, which were always made to God, you know, they completely blinded themselves to their principles. And so now we have this Supreme Court, you know, jurisprudence, which at times waffles. But whenever they adhere to the principle, it's clear that, you know, we want to treat people equally in terms of certain things. Skin color, which came second, and religion, which came first, are two of the ones that we want people treated equally. And you can't possibly, you can no more say that we're treating atheists equally when we say in God we trust, than you can say we're treating blacks equally were you to say in the Caucasian race we trust. It's an absurd concept, and it's just shameful that we have federal judges, appellate judges, upholding this kind of nonsense.
Well, Mike Newdow, emergency physician, lawyer activist, and minister, thank you very, very much for sharing this with us, and we'll have to check back in with you later and get an update and see if you managed to get our national motto taken off of our currency.
That would be lovely.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've just finished a really interesting interview with Michael Newdow all about why he is challenging the phrase, "In God We Trust," which appears, of course, as our national motto in a number of places, most notably on U.S. currency. As you might guess, not everybody agrees with Dr. Newdow, and one fellow in particular who does not agree with him is named Matthew Staver. Matthew is currently with a group called the Liberty Council, and he's formerly the dean of the law school at Liberty University.
I'm Matt Staver. I'm the founder and chairman of Liberty Council. My wife, Anita, is also an attorney. We founded it in 1989. It's an international litigation, education, and policy organization. Our focus is to advance religious freedom, the sanctity of human life, and the family. And we do that all over the country. And we have a major outreach in Israel. We have a humanitarian branch called Liberty Relief International that helps persecuted Christians around the world. We've been before the United States Supreme Court, have cases currently pending at the United States Supreme Court, and have litigated a lot on the issue of religious liberty and church-state issues.
And I just somehow sense that you've done a number of radio interviews before, too.
I've done a few radio interviews, that's right.
Well, I've been reading about you for years, and it's a great pleasure finally to speak to you. Our particular topic today, though it sounds like we could talk endlessly about a number of the things you're doing, the particular reason that we're together today is that apparently Michael Newdow of In God We Trust fame, or I should say actually of Pledge of Allegiance fame, has filed a lawsuit in Ohio, and he is seeking to have the motto, the national motto, In God We Trust, removed from our currency. And again, I'm going to take a wild guess that you don't think that's such a good idea.
No, I don't. I think it's a frivolous lawsuit. It's been tried and failed before, but certainly every lawsuit you have to take seriously. But in this particular case, there have been other attempts to try to remove In God We Trust from currency or from different kinds of inscriptions. And one after another, they've all failed. His attempt to get the Pledge of Allegiance struck down as unconstitutional because it mentions one nation under God, similar to In God We Trust in the currency in our motto. Then we also see that he failed in that particular one as well. So consequently, what you have here is another attempt by Michael Newdow to do the same thing that he's failed at doing before.
Yeah, but he seems to have gotten himself his guns in order this time. Of course, he was dismissed on standing grounds on the Pledge of Allegiance case. And I don't know if you felt the same way I did. I felt kind of cheated by that because I really wanted the court to go directly to the main issue and to opine on that. But more generally, correct me if I'm wrong, but most of the challenges to In God We Trust have been under the Establishment Clause. And this challenge is under the federal RFRA statute.
Yeah, and I think that's even going to be a more difficult challenge for him. The other challenges, you're right, have been under the Establishment Clause, that somehow this is an establishment of religion, and the courts, one after another, have rejected that particular argument. And now he's switching gears and trying to say that this violates the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the federal law that protects religious free exercise. The problem with that is the question you're going to have to ask, and he's going to have to prove, is how does having In God We Trust on the currency affect his or burden his right to worship or to practice his faith? It certainly doesn't. So I think he's going to have even a more difficult chance under the RFRA than he has had or other people have had under the Establishment Clause.
Yeah, you may be right, because, of course, the statutory standard, I mean, the threshold issue is that there's got to be some sort of substantial burden, and that presupposes that there is some sort of religious belief involved. Now, I guess he's got a number of co-plaintiffs or people he's representing, and they're from probably a variety of religious backgrounds, but he himself is an atheist, and I don't think that atheism would necessarily qualify as a religion to be protected in the first instance. And then the argument about what sort of burden is being put on him, that is a little bit difficult as well. I think from what I understand, he's arguing that simply carrying around and being forced to conduct business economic transactions with a currency that says something that's contrary to his beliefs is a substantial enough burden to get him over that threshold issue. But I guess you just don't think that is.
No, I don't think so. You know, for example, on the Establishment Clause, the courts over the past have really given an exception to the standing rules. The standing rules, of course, mean that you have to have some kind of direct injury that can be redressed by a successful litigation. Mm-hmm. And in most cases, the Establishment Clause kinds of lawsuits would all be rejected based on standing, but the courts have given a lower threshold for standing for the Establishment Clause. But they haven't done that for religious free exercise. It has the same standard of requirement that you prove a direct injury and somehow a favorable redress by virtue of the lawsuit. So he's going to have even a more difficult standing problem here, I think, than he did even in the Pledge of Allegiance case, where he got knocked out on standing. And I agree, I would have hoped that the Supreme Court would have addressed the issue of the Pledge of Allegiance in its merits rather than just dismiss it on standing. But sometimes the court does that if it doesn't have to reach the merits. Other courts have addressed the merits of the Pledge of Allegiance. Many courts have addressed the merits of In God We Trust, and there's not one court anywhere that ultimately, as a court of last resort, has struck down In God We Trust under the Establishment Clause, in which people are granted greater opportunity to sue than they would be under, say, a free exercise or the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today we're discussing the phrase, in God we trust. Previously, we heard from Mike Newdow, who is against the phrase, who's trying to have it removed from our currency, and now we're in the middle of a discussion with Matt Staver of Liberty Counsel, who thinks that it should stay. After the break, we'll finish our conversation with Matt Staver, so stick around. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish our discussion about the phrase, in God we trust. Should it stay on our currency, or is its placement there unconstitutional? Previously, we spoke with Michael Newdow, who's trying to have it removed, but now we're speaking with Matt Staver with a group called Liberty Counsel, and Matt is pointing out something that might seem a little obscure to you. The issue is called standing, and the idea is that somebody like Mike Newdow, who wants the phrase taken off the currency, can't just complain as a citizen or someone who's concerned about it. Mr. Newdow, Dr. Newdow, has to show a specific concrete injury, an injury that the court can redress, can actually fix before he can get into court.
Let's just assume for the moment that he does get over that initial burden of showing that he has a substantial burden on his religious belief somehow, and he does get to the meaty issue. Could you give us a brief rundown on the sorts of arguments that you think that he is going to present and your responses to them? I think essentially what they boil down to is that the government has no business mentioning God on currency in such a way that it could possibly inflict any sort of injury on people of differing religious beliefs.
Well, I think you'd have to go through the steps here.
Sure, please do.
He had the right to be able to sue. The first thing is he'd have to show, does he have a sincerely held religious belief? What is that belief? Mm-hmm. I assume what he will argue is that his belief is that he doesn't believe that God exists. So when you say in God we trust, that is contrary to his belief. So let's just assume he passes that threshold. Mm-hmm. The big one is going to be, what is the substantial burden on his free exercise of religion, of his belief? What is it that's prohibiting him from acting? You take, for example, RFRA. Here's how it was designed to classically apply. Someone in prison is not allowed to have a certain meal that is consistent with their faith, or they're not allowed to grow their beard long that's consistent with their faith. Or, for example, in another case, someone who is part of a church, they're not allowed to actually establish a church because the zoning laws say that you can't even begin to exist. So they're stopped in their ability to carry out their faith. The church is not able to even begin operation. The other person is required to constantly violate their belief that may require their hair to grow long or for them to not eat pork or certain other kinds of foods. So every single time that they're encountering this particular law or regulation, they're not able to carry out their belief, their particular religious conviction. So that's a substantial burden. The question then comes up after that. We'll get to that in a moment. Now, let's just look at the substantial burden question here. In this case, what is the substantial burden on his exercise of non-belief? What is it that he is being forced to do that he can't do, or what it is that he's being forced not to do that he can, that he wants to do? It really is nothing. So I think he's going to have a hard time showing. He might be able to show offense, but he can't show substantial burden, and that's what's required under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. How is it that you have been substantially burdened, completely, essentially impeded in the carrying out of your sincerely held religious belief? I think that's the burden that he has that he's not going to be able to jump over. Beyond that, and we'll talk, go ahead, and there's a third one after that. Has the government been able to show that it is achieving its interest in the least restrictive means available. We'll talk about that in a few moments.
Sure. Yeah, that's really getting to the meat of it then. But you're right. I mean, that is, he seems to have set himself a very tough row to hoe here. I think he's going to have to construct some sort of argument that his religious beliefs require him to do nothing that would acknowledge the existence of a deity, and that using money, a currency that has the phrase "In God We Trust" upon it, offends that belief. And yet he has no alternative because he must transact business, occasionally at least, using currency. I think that's the sort of argument he's going to have to construct.
That's the only possible argument that he could construct, and I think it is so far-fetched that that will not win the day. If in fact that does win the day, that indeed anything that offends you, which is really what he's doing, he's offended by the fact that the currency has "In God We Trust" on it, and he's saying that he has to carry this around, and therefore it's a violation of his belief, not his religious belief, but his basically a religious belief, which is in itself an interesting twist, because RFRA wasn't really designed for no belief. It was designed for the exercise of religious belief. But assuming he gets past that, he's going to have to show that his offense or his carrying money around somehow substantially burdens his non-belief or his atheistic views. And I think if he were to win on that, it would open Pandora's box with regards to RFRA, such that anything that you see, that you encounter, can now also be not only an establishment of religion, but a free exercise of religion. And so anything goes. There's really no standard. There's really no definition of what an exercise of religion is or a burden on the exercise of religion. Anything that you see or encounter that's offensive, maybe it's any symbol, any display, can now be turned into a free exercise of religion. And it becomes a little tangential and, frankly, a little bit hard to manage. So I don't think the courts are going to open that Pandora's box, because there's really no parameter you can then set on what a free exercise of religion is.
Yep, he's got at least two important and difficult steps, the standing and then showing a substantial burden on a religious belief. But let's just assume, for the sake of argument, he gets past those two burdens and we finally get to where the government has a burden. And the burden the government would have at that point is to show that it satisfies something called strict scrutiny, that it has a compelling interest that it's trying to serve, and that it's used, as you say, the least restrictive means to do that. What compelling interest could the government assert for putting the phrase "In God We Trust" on the currency?
Well, you know, once you get past the first two hurdles and you're to the government having to show that it's completed its interest or achieved or sought to achieve its interest in the least restrictive means available, that's when it becomes almost a win for the plaintiff and a defeat for the government. Not in every case, mm-hmm. but certainly it's going to be a very difficult burden for the government to uphold. What is it that they can do that is less restrictive and still carry out their objective? The objective, obviously, is going to be in the currency, having the currency available for people to transmit activity, economic activity. Can they achieve that ultimate interest in the same manner without impinging someone's belief? Well, sure, you could argue that they can remove "In God We Trust" and you still have the currency and you still have the economic transactions without the language of "In God We Trust" on there. So that's, I think, an easier argument for him if he can get to that point. On the other hand, I think before I think what the government will argue is what some courts have done, and that is "In God We Trust." Interestingly, I don't agree with this particular statement, but courts have routinely used this, and that is "In God We Trust" has become so used over time that even if it had a religious purpose at the very beginning or a religious meaning, it no longer does. It's just a national motto that is part of our motto, and it's on the currency. So it's a secular statement. And therefore, it has nothing to do. The government can't do anything different, because if it were to take it off or leave it, it doesn't really affect anything, because it doesn't have any religious purpose at all. And I think that gets you back to, really, before you get to this last prong, it gets you back to what we were just talking about. How does this impinge his free exercise of religion? When, in fact, the government, I think, will argue or could argue, that it's not a religious statement at all. Now, in my view, In God We Trust clearly is a religious statement. It was designed from its very beginning to be a religious statement. I don't think by just mere usage over time you wear it out so much and you drain it of all religious meaning. I think it still does have religious meaning. On the other hand, there's many people that use it, that have seen it so much that for them it's just a motto and it doesn't have that religious meaning. I think that is going to be a big part of the argument that the government will address on the second prong, the substantial burden. How does something that they may argue, which has no religious meaning at all, it has a secular purpose, impinge on someone's free exercise of religion any more than E Pluribus Unum would infringe on your free exercise of religion?
Yeah, I think the government probably would be in pretty bad shape if Newdo actually makes it over those first two hurdles, because, you know, as you say, when you get to that point and the government has to meet that so-called strict scrutiny, they almost always lose. Not always, but almost always. Well, we're borrowing a little bit in our analysis from the other cases, which, of course, were brought under Establishment Clause. And as you've pointed out, when the government has justified the In God We Trust motto in other challenges, it's done so essentially by saying that it's history, it's tradition, and it's not really religious. You've already mentioned that you disagree with that aspect of it. I wonder if we could develop a little bit further, though, your attitude toward the motto or under God in the pledge generally. What does this mean for you? What is important about this? How do we justify this under either RFRA or under the Establishment Clause?
Well, I think you go back to In God We Trust really predates the adoption on our currency and our national motto. So it's much earlier than the 1950s, for example, when we included it into the Pledge of Allegiance. It's something that was used going all the way back to the founders, and it was picked up and eventually become our national motto, put on our currency, and put in the Pledge of Allegiance. It was put in the Pledge of Allegiance at that time because of communism, an atheistic government, and someone would be pledging to the United States of America. That would be consistent with who we are, and that is the Supreme Court has recognized time and time again that we are a religious people. Our institutions presuppose the existence of a supreme being. That's the Supreme Court's words. They've gone through history after history, statement after statement, with respect to the religious heritage and foundation of our country. So I think when you do an analysis of the Establishment Clause or the Free Exercise Clause, either one, question you have to ask is, even if it is religious, how has it tended to establish a religion? And has it, if it had that tendency to establish a religion, surely over 200 plus years, we would have seen an establishment of religion. And certainly since it was put in the Pledge of Allegiance, we would have seen some kind of preferential denominational or religious treatment or an establishment of religion. We would have seen in practice in history some kind of impingement on people's free exercise of religion. And history has shown that we have been able to coexist with the motto, with our history and our heritage, and yet have our religious freedom, one of the greatest freedoms that we have here in America, that is an example to those around the world. So we've been able to coexist with our history, acknowledging our heritage, and yet not establishing a religion, not preferring a denomination, not preferring or having religious tests, and allowing people to freely exercise their faith.
Yeah, we certainly have, but I'm trying to put myself in the position of somebody like Newdow, who doesn't believe in any God, and of course he sees this, though the argument has been rejected repeatedly, he sees this as some sort of an avowal that there is one God. So in some sense it's an endorsement of monotheism, and of course as interpreted by most Americans, the majority of whom profess some sort of Christian faith, it has a very specific God in mind. So either he, as one who believes in no God, or perhaps somebody who's of the Hindu faith, who believes in many gods perhaps, or somebody of the Islamic faith who believes in a different God, or perhaps even a Jew, if they perceive this as an endorsement of the Christian God. All of those people have tried and failed to make Establishment Clause claims, but I'm just curious, how do you respond to such arguments? You know, if you had to argue that case in the Supreme Court, and you have argued in the Supreme Court, how would you respond to those sorts of arguments?
Well, I think I would go back to, for example, what the Supreme Court has done with regards to prayer, specific prayer before legislative sessions and bodies, mm-hmm. first in the Nebraska state legislature, and now most recently before the individual local bodies of government, both of which said that it's constitutional. And these are specific prayers. Some of them are decidedly Christian prayers. And they said that that does not violate the Establishment Clause. In the case of the original prayer case before the United States Supreme Court on the state legislative level, they indicated that the history and the ubiquity, the widespread use of it, in other words, and the longstanding history of prayer throughout our history has been consistent with and coexistence has coexisted with the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause, which was at issue in those cases. And consequently, there's no evidence through our history that there has been any tendency, let alone an establishment of religion, by virtue of these legislative prayers. I think the same thing is true with the motto, "In God We Trust," and the phrase, "In God We Trust," that predates the adoption of it as our motto. It is part of our history. In the same way that it doesn't get drained of its religious meaning by virtue of its usage and therefore become secular, you have also, in the same way, it doesn't become an establishment of religion because someone later in time decides to challenge it because they're offended. It is what it is, and history has shown that it is part and parcel of our history, our heritage, our currency, our motto, our statements, our communication. And at no time has it attended to establish a religion. So I would look at it from that perspective. Obviously, there's the other perspectives as well that I already indicated personally I wouldn't adopt, but certainly courts have adopted it, and that is by usage over time, and it may be a different way of saying the same thing, by usage over time, it has been drained of its religious meaning. I think really what we're looking at is by usage over time, history not hasn't necessarily drained it of its religious meaning, which I don't think is true. Some people might argue it is true. But over usage through our time frame of our history, we have not seen any tendency that it would tend to or even lead towards an establishment of religion or interfere with someone's free exercise of religion.
Well, Matt Staver of Liberty Counsel, formerly the Dean of Liberty University Law School, thanks so very much for sharing your analysis with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure to be with you.
Well, now that we've heard from both sides in this debate, let's hear from Bill Maher, who says he doesn't care at all.
Now, speaking as America's favorite celebrity atheist. And here's the thing America is going to be learning as more people turn to atheism. It's not that we're militant. It's that we don't give a shit. God on money? I don't really care on which of your treasured totems you scroll the name of your myth. Put Hello Kitty on the flag. Knock yourself out. If the $50 bill says, "Kneel before Allah, white devil," but they still take it down at the dispensary, I'm good.
And that's our show. Thanks to both of our guests today, to Michael Newdow, who is challenging the phrase, "In God We Trust," on our currency, and to Matt Staver of Liberty Counsel, who, let's just say he disagrees with Michael Newdow. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harrison. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment.